Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Jackie Cation here. You're listening to The Dork Forest. You know the websites, dorkforest.com, thedorkforest.com, if you like a determiner. JackieCation.com has everything. Both of my podcasts, all of the stand-up stuff, the new album, links to YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, all the things. But so, I think, does dorkforest.com, where you can look at old videos of different shows. Anyway, if you want to support the show, tell people about the show, review it on iTunes, thumbs it up on Pandora or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, I appreciate that. You can donate. You can donate monthly. PayPal lets you do that. You can also do my Venmo if you like. It's at Jackie Cation absolutely everywhere. And my email address is jackie@jackiecation.com. And that's what the PayPal is. The PayPal link is on jackiecation.com and dorkforest.com. And go to any of them. Thanks for listening. There's merch. There's stand-up. There's tour guide. You know, you can find out where I'm touring. This is getting long, so let's get into the show.
Hi, Jackie Cation here. Full of rage. Usually not usual. Not usual at... Hi. Not normal in front of a dork forest, but I'm full of rage. How's it going out there? The Supreme Court has destroyed Roe, so we all need to step up and fight back. The good news is our friends at Abortion Action Front have a plan. July 17th, they're hosting an activist training day called Operation Save Abortion. AAF is gathering experts from every area of the abortion justice movement and live streaming a series of conversations that break down the many ways that you can help protect reproductive rights. Real things that you can do. So helping patients with travel needs, lobbying politicians, getting into good trouble out in the streets are just a few of the opportunities these amazing panelists will break down. Specifically, and bonus, they'll connect you with the organizations in your area doing this work. So gather your friends for a watch party and commit to being a defender of abortion access. Operation Save Abortion, July 17th. For all info and to register, hit up OperationSaveAbortion.com. It's online. Everybody can do this. We can all do this. July 17th. Get out there. OperationSaveAbortion.com.
Hey, Jackie Cation here. I'm in my garage. Who wants to see that closet door? Don't we want to see this version? Yeah, there we go. Hi. You're listening to The Dork Forest. You've chosen wisely. And let's do it. I am with Gianmarco Cerezzi. And
yeah, perfect.
Yeah, there we go. Cerezzi, got it. There's part of me wants to ethnic it up, really get into the Italian of it. And stand-up comic has a podcast called The Downside, which sounds like if you're ever sick of talking about what you love, go listen to The Downside because it's it's a great chance to bitch about shit is what it sounds like. Is it really fun?
Oh, it's a blast because everyone's always, you know, everyone's become their own like PR person online and everyone's happy. And then you go home
guilty.
And why am I not happy as everyone else?
Right. Right. There's these beautiful pictures of, yeah, it's true. Whenever anybody is like, I've taken a picture of us, I was like, I will like it. But if I genuinely like it, I will retweet it or I will repost it. But if I don't like it, then you will just get a heart that says, well, you posted something about me and I appreciate that. Because that's what it is. It's all about PR. So Gianmarco Cerezzi has a podcast called The Downside, does stand-up comedy. So you could go probably and Gianmarco Cerezzi, it's Soresi, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be in the notes, everybody, for that's his handle for everything. Twitter, Instagram, all the things, right?
Yeah. At last I saw you, we were both performing at Flappers together.
There you go.
And we, you, me, and Jay Leno in the green room.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Talking about how cancel culture has gone too far. We were not leading the conversation.
Not leading the conversation because it's Jay Leno might have a little bit of the world's gone mad. But he is 72. So
He is.
And he shouldn't. Yeah, he should just talk about stand up and cars because that's what he's made up of. He's made up of stand up and cars. And his wife is a philanthropist. So you would think that he would have some. And he does. He's actually a much nicer guy than Everyone who works for Conan tells me. So, because everyone who works for Conan is mad.
And, of course.
But you are going to be in Toronto and we have Canadian listeners. There's people dorking out in Canada, the whole state, the whole country, the whole province, the whole, oh, Canada. 7/22 and 23 of July, Toronto. Which venue?
I think it's something new. It's called like the National Comedy Theater.
Okay.
Which makes it sound like it's only 50 seats, and that's a lot of words for a 50-seat box.
Right. That's a letter for everybody. Get out there. Go to the Toronto. Go to just follow them. Look them up. If you live in Toronto, you can figure this out. We believe in you. Mm-hmm. And then you're doing like Irvine and Oxnard, the Improvs or Levities or Live Nations or whatever they are,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Those big rooms.
The big rooms that you're like hoping to fill it. Bring a friend. So that's 8/7 and 8/10 in August. So if you live outskirts of Los Angeles. So Gianmarco, here's where I'm at with the Dork Forest. You have a dorkdom I don't think we've done before, which is the television program Seinfeld, which is people talk about sitcoms. They love sitcoms. It was, but you were a Seinfeld guy.
I was a Seinfeld guy. I have divorced parents and like my father's not the Jewish one. My mom's Jewish. But my father and I would watch Seinfeld religiously. It was at least Thursdays
almost
is
like
what
a
I remember.
Religion. Was it like a Jewish religion? Seems unlikely.
I think it's more like my father's depressed. And there's something, when you're depressed, you become a little more Jewish. There's something about the complaining and the negativity and the narcissism.
It just really resonated?
It so did. And my father, it was the most bonding I've had with my father, I would say. And I think I learned my sense of humor from Seinfeld. I think I wasn't raised very Jewish, and yet I have Jewish traits. And I sometimes think it's because of Seinfeld.
Oh,
really?
You know what? It's a great introduction to some sort of secular Judaism that I think we all liked because the timing was there. I mean, historically, you know, according to every book about the history of stand-up comedy, it was all Jews. Let me tell you something. There were some Jewish women. Let me just say. I'm just gonna go out there. There was probably a lady or two with a mouth. That's what she had. She was like, "You got a mouth on you. We're not gonna put you in the book." But but I will say that what years? It was like 90, right? Didn't it start in?
I think it started in 88 or 89. I believe 89.
Okay.
And it had a, I rewatched the documentary and it was a wild ride. I mean, I was born in 88.
Right.
And it was one of these things. Seinfeld was a big, Johnny Carson. He was on all the time. I think he was guest hosting now and then. NBC gave him a deal, and he just liked Larry David. He just liked Larry David. And every story about Larry David, they're always like, "Oh, he's the comedian's." I've never heard a story of Larry David killing. I've only heard stories of like, we liked watching Larry David because sometimes he just walked off the stage. Which,
that's
I don't know.
Not how stand-up comedy becomes popular. Like,
yeah.
But there's a couple of people who could do it. Kindler can do it, right? Like Andy
Kindler.
They
can.
Yeah.
But in today's environment of stand-up comedy, you tell me if you think I'm incorrect. Like, there's so many comics competing for spots right now that, like, if I stormed off the stage, you'd have to have a lot of clout to then get another spot the next week. That's a club banner these days.
I would think at certain levels, certainly at this level. See, when you storm off stage, and I've never done it, but I've decided recently that I will. I've decided that I won't go up if I think that the show is going to be unsafe. I used to have this sort of bring it. I can take it. What am I, a chihuahua? Jesus. It's like there's no reason for me to think that I can take what, because there's bad guys, right? It could get super dangerous. And
of course,
I have had some bad experiences in the last couple of years. And so I have recently decided that I will not be going up. And if I lose the weekend, so sad, too bad. I lived. And then if I also feel unsafe on stage, I've decided I'm gonna get off because of those two reasons. Chad Daniels does it. And he's sort of at our level, but he seems somehow on the cusp of being Bert Kreischer.
the cusp of being Bill Burr, right?
Like, sure, sure.
Because he's so freaking funny, but he's also super sane. So who knows if he'll ever be those guys? Not that those guys are insane. That's what they implicate the unsaid word. Anyway.
It's flattering you said our level. I'm down here.
We're peers, Gianmarco. We're peers.
I appreciate that. You know, you, me, and Jay Leno, we're all peers. We were all
in the green room hanging out.
The only time I've seen a comic, I worked a pretty rough club in New York called LOL. And there was a comic who, his name is Kenny Ortega. He passed away from COVID, sadly.
Oh, shit.
But he had been working this club for over a decade. When it was called Ha, went from Ha to LOL.
Oh, I remember Ha.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I never played Ha.
It's good for you. That's why we're different levels. And he was closing all the shows, and they dropped the checks on him. And he had, you know, worked his club for so long, and it's a mess. And when they start dropping the checks, he went off. He said, I don't do the check spot here. And let me tell you, maybe in some places it'd be like, come on. But this place, good for you. You got to take it.
Own the fact that you've been treading water for 10 years. You don't deserve the check spot.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Because the check spot in New York is very different than anywhere else I've ever played. It literally is mayhem. It was like that. You might as well say, hey, we're going to stick you in the middle of a playground, throw a bunch of balls in the air, and then say, do your set. You get 15. And you're like, no, I didn't want 15 here. Is this, why don't you do it after? Or why don't you not make it into a parade?
Sure.
It's weird because on the road, when you do the checks, when the checks drop on the road, it's not a madhouse.
In New York, it seems that the fastest the servers are moving is just when they're going to do that one moment. Yeah. I'm like, let's do it in waves.
We could do something. There's another way to go about this, but nope. Anyway, so it was interesting when Seinfeld, when I remember, actually it was, that's right, because it was 88, because I saw him, I didn't see him. It was 1990. I wasn't paying for comedy. I've never paid. One time I paid to see the one-liner guy from Boston who's hilarious. Whose name is escaping me, you know.
How old or young?
Older.
Or middle.
Older. Like in his probably 60 right now, because he's the guy, right?
The guy, Steve Wright.
That's it, Stephen Wright.
Steve Wright.
I paid for him one time because it had to be 1987. And I was like, I gotta see what 45 minutes of that looks like. Uh-huh. And I'll tell you something, it wasn't all one-liners. Stephen Wright.
Wow. Interesting.
Because it could not be sustained. Because people would lose their minds and decide to live their lives and go, I'll come back and he'll probably still be talking. So it was a little storytelling. There was a little more to it. It was great. He's a genius, obviously. But I'm going to eventually let you talk, Gianmarco. And
I love hearing about Stephen Wright. That's great.
But I will tell you this, is when Jerry Seinfeld played Minneapolis, I moved to Minneapolis in 1990. Uh-huh. And so the show had been on for two, maybe three seasons. It was doing good, but it hadn't blown up, right?
Yeah.
And so he was playing a decent sized theater. It was probably 800 to 1,000 people. And I've told the story many times, Rangers, hear it again. So they're all the comics, all the young comics would hang out with the mogul of Minneapolis comedy at that time was a man named Scott Hansen. And Scott Hansen had five clubs in 1992 in Minneapolis, five clubs. And he was a button pusher extraordinaire, just passed away a couple of years ago. I have a giant scar on my finger right here. It is because he,
oh my God,
he made me so mad. And then I punched a wall. So
Wow. Guess
who's the bad guy? I'm not the hero of that story. So, but neither is he. Anyway, so there are no heroes in that story. But here's the scoop. He's a big guy. He weighs maybe 500-600 pounds.
If I saw you punch a wall, I'd be telling that story on every podcast for the rest of my life.
Right, right. And in 1993, when it happened, I bet you it was... It was definitely, there would have been a reason to tell it because I had very little control over my entire life in 1993.
They should do that instead of having comics sign the walls. That's so cliche. Every comic should punch a hole in the wall until the club falls down and it's time for a new one.
New club. The So anyway, Seinfeld goes up. He comes off stage. He's doing something what I think is the quintessential Seinfeld thing in the green room after the show. There's probably four or five male comics. I heard this from one of the dudes who was there. And if you hung out with Scott Hansen, the guy who owned the clubs in Minneapolis, you would always eat. So if you were broke, you would hang out with Scott. And you're like, oh, yeah. Every 20 to 40 minutes, there's going to be a pizza ordered or some fucking thing. I got to, you know, it was a way to save money. It was dumb. But so they're all sitting around the green room. And Scott's trying to talk Jerry into going to do a set at one of his five clubs. And Jerry's like, no, I've already done stand-up. I'm done. But get this. Jerry Seinfeld is sitting in the green room with Scott and all these comics, sewing a button on his shirt. Can't you picture it? It's like an episode of the Seinfeld. And so he goes, I've already performed. I don't want to. And so they're talking and Scott finally goes, well, do you want to go get something to eat? And while he's sewing, Seinfeld goes, Scott, you've eaten. And yeah, which is brutal and not nice. very Seinfeld, because that's the thing about Seinfeld is it wasn't particularly nice. That show.
Yeah, well, that's what I love about it. I like mean comedy. I did improv and the teacher always said, Jamarco, be nice.
Oh,
like note, like I'd follow the rules. I'd say yes and, but it was like, yes and you suck. And the teacher was like, that's not cool. That's how I knew I needed to be a stand-up because
right,
just
solo,
you know.
Solo work. Yeah.
So I like that meanness. I don't know. I think the thesis of everything I do is just like, yeah, everyone's bad.
Okay.
And Seinfeld, they, I think it was Larry or Jerry where they were like, no sentiment, no sentimentality ever. There's not a moment in that show. And that's why the finale didn't fully work, in my opinion, because there is no conclusiveness.
Right. There's no repercussions.
You can't bring it to a head because there was no momentum. You right. just should have gone out with a good episode. That's
right.
it.
Right. They're just it. Like, well, I'll see you tomorrow. And sort of the Sopranos, where just they're sitting at that diner and then it just fades to black and you're like, oh, they continue to live their lives. Lady and the Tiger.
I could see someone killing George. I could totally see someone killing George.
Right. It doesn't have to be a gunshot. Yeah. It was interesting about the guy who played George, who has a name.
Jason Alexander.
There, thank you very much, Jason Alexander. I believe I saw an interview with him once where he said, I don't understand how people relate to these characters. They're monsters. My character is the biggest asshole in the world. Why would you relate to this guy? Yeah.
I think that's like Larry David, again, with Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is, it's like second wave of this kind of comedy.
Right.
I've heard from women on dating apps that at least men my age, I'm in my 30s and 20s, there's so many that say Larry David is my spirit animal or Curb Your Enthusiasm is my best show. Mm-hmm. And I think what it is, it's just like, again, I don't want to say this is just a Jewish thing, but as a Jew and with a girlfriend as a Jew, I think like the complaining, there's something about like, it's okay to complain.
Sure.
It's okay to like talk about the nice event, and complaining doesn't mean you didn't have a good time. It doesn't mean you don't want to go back.
Right.
And I think,
but
like,
did you notice that there were toothpicks that didn't have the curly cues on top? That
of
was
course.
Like, you're like,
and so I think like people who are not in that realm, Larry David is like, it's like the first time they're like, yeah, I always had complaints too that I never thought we could talk about. And we can be fun about it. So they over-relate.
Yes.
And they're like, okay, well, I can be an asshole now. And it's like, well, no, this is exaggerated.
Right.
That's the part they miss.
Right. And it makes me glad I'm not on the dating app. Though I will say, when I was dating, it was 2000. In 2000, and the joy that was there. I have a friend who once said to me, there are people who like Friends and there are people who like Seinfeld. And I have recently had people in their 20s and 30s say, Friends is also super mean. It is also self-absorbed and full of jackasses. And but I loved Friends. I think I loved it because it was a little less mean and it was couched in some sentiment. But they weren't particularly any nicer.
Yeah. I just think the sentiment, I don't know. I especially now these days, this was always my complaint with Parks and Recreation, where every two episodes, like, friendship's really important, right? And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
You don't like anime? Is that what I'm hearing? Is that what I'm hearing? You don't like
I grew up in anime, but I like the cynical anime.
Right.
That was my other dork thought.
So no
was
Dragon
anime.
Ball Z? No,
Dragon Ball Z. I did love Dragon Ball Z.
Right, it's Naruto? You didn't like Naruto? Every episode is about friendship. It's like, you know who's great? This guy. I'm going to hang in the sky and be full of rage, but he's got my back. And but the thing is you get to like, I was just busting your chops because get to like both. That's fine. I mean, the thing is what you love about Seinfeld is that it's completely, there's no point.
Yeah, and it's very funny. First, the show, for a mainstream show, Seinfeld was so meta. There were so many meta references.
Right, inside baseball, kind of?
Yeah. And so the history of the show, it was amazing because, A, the test audiences hated the pilot. They said it was too Jewish. They said it was too New York.
Right.
And they, like, released it as this crazy thing where they filmed it like they aired it in the Saturday Night Live slot, and it was like a special. It was like how a stand-up comedian makes their material. That was the pitch of it. Mm-hmm. And then they did a 4-episode order for a first season, and it was just like everything about it seemed doomed to fail.
They were like, this is never gonna go. This is never gonna be popular. So they did one, and they aired it like Saturday night at 10:30?
Yeah, they aired it.
And then they made 4 episodes?
They did 4 episodes after that, and they demanded, the first episode does not have Elaine. It was just like 3 dudes. And the one network note that they gave, they said, you have to have a woman.
I am gonna sharpen this pen. Yes, it's so sad for Carol Leifer. Yes.
Yep. And Larry David had worked with Julie Louis-Dreyfus on SNL. Larry David did 1 year of SNL,
mm-hmm.
and then did a show called Fridays, I think it was called, the SNL competitor with Michael Richards was on Friday.
Okay.
But just this cast, I think what's incredible about Seinfeld is, first, Jerry Seinfeld, not a good actor.
Those first couple of seasons, you're like, you're watching everyone just sort of carry him around from one part of that the set to the other. And him just woodenly saying things.
But it feels right for the show. Like, it feels, it's one of the few comic-driven shows where it feels like they did it. He never had to overextend himself. It's just him complaining. It's just him doing bits. But that cast is incredible.
Yeah, he got Jason Alexander, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and Michael Richards to literally... And everybody else was, and granted, they were sketch or they were improv, but they weren't stand-ups. And trying to teach a stand-up comic how to act is its own project. And the fact that it was successful created all of the 1990s where everybody got, or many, many deals were cut with comics that were not, who couldn't even act to the level of Jerry Seinfeld. Right. Or they didn't do the casting right around them to hold him up. Right.
Of course. And Jerry, like, notoriously, he really talks. He doesn't respect acting very much. He doesn't respect the concept of acting. And I started as an actor. I'm one of these actor-turned-comedians.
Right. Improv. Like, acting, improv, well, I went and to then
college.
Stand-up?
I went to college for musical theater. I wanted to be Daniel Day-Lewis. I was an actor. I studied all the teachers. And like Seinfeld notoriously just kind of goes like, hey, you memorize your lines. Well, why are you getting a trophy? You said someone else's lines.
Wow, nice and impression.
Thank you. Believe me, I've auditioned a couple times
You first started doing stand-up, did you find yourself doing a little bit of his observational style?
I think a little. I think I more like sounded too much like Mulaney, but Mulaney definitely feels like of the trajectory of Seinfeld, in terms of that kind of voice.
And you have to find your own voice eventually anyway, so you're going to sound like somebody.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about Seinfeld is just like he was so... you know, part of it feels hacky now, that idea of like, what's the deal with, but he really crystallized some version of that.
It's hacky because it's been hacked. I mean, there was him and a handful of guys were doing that super observational version, yeah. And it was set up punch. And he was in that era when it was, you were supposed to get something like a laugh every second and a half. And there was this, like in 60 seconds, in every minute, you were supposed to get something like 30 laughs. And you're like, wild. Well, you're out of your goddamn mind. But it was because that was his thing. But I remember the first time I saw, and I didn't even see it, I heard Richard Pryor, a Richard Pryor album. And we're talking 15 years ago. I never listened to stand-up. So yeah. I'm listening to this thing and I was like, oh, I see where everything else came from, right? Mm. I mean, there's so many guys who came from that place. And then made it their own, obviously, right? Like Bernie yeah. Mac and all of the kings of comedy. They're all doing some version of Richard Pryor. Sure. And until they had their own voice. But Richard Pryor, like, opened the door. And much like Seinfeld, opened the door to talking about the mundane and making it really funny and personalizing it.
Yeah. And I don't know. Sometimes you hear old Seinfeld. It's very – I was watching that George Carlin documentary. And they're both kind of comedians that, like – I think in their weaker times get a little bit too obsessed with language.
Yeah.
Like Seinfeld loves to be like, you go in the train, but you go on the boardwalk.
Yeah.
On the inn. And you're like, who gives a fuck about any of this?
He's
it's just that way because it is.
He's fishing for premises. I don't know if you've ever, where you're just like, what else happened? Did anything else happen? I got to find a premise. And he's the guy that writes that joke. So
I went to the taping of his Netflix special where he did all the old material.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the last time?
Yeah, the last time. No, not the Broadway one, but he did like a Netflix one where he like did all his material up to his first Carson appearance.
Oh, weird.
It was like his first Netflix special. And they didn't say that during the show. So he was doing these materials about like, he was doing a chunk on cotton balls. And I'm sitting there like, what the fuck? You're talking about cotton balls in 2022? And then he did some bit about his parents moving to Florida. And I was like, your parents are dead.
Right.
Oh, this is all old material. Okay,
yeah, they might want to let people in on that. That's nuts.
It was very strange. When I realized it, I was like, oh, okay,
good.
I get the conceit.
Yeah, they're going to have to sweeten the hell out of this, the first 20 minutes of this, until everybody realizes what the hell is going on. That's so funny.
But the first time I saw him in New York, I was so excited. And then at a certain point, if I was hosting the second show at Gotham and I came in and Seinfeld was on the first show, I was like, my show's starting late.
Oh,
that's what that means.
Yeah. It's there's a certain point in your career where you're like, you have to be aware of the fact that everybody wants to get up. And if you're doing a work in this one right here, I can strong arm my way in over at Flappers for a
sure.
five. For a five. And and if I run the light, I've done a seven. So.
Oh, my God. I was once hosting at West Side Comedy Club in New York. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Seinfeld, like right before, tweeted, I'm going to go to West Side Comedy Club. But tweeted the Twitter for the West Side at your end in L.A.
Oh, weird.
And so like West Side in your end had to like clarify Seinfeld is not coming here.
Right.
Then Seinfeld just tweeted in New York. And I'm hosting, and so people start realizing this mid-show that Seinfeld's coming. And the number of yarmulkes that came into this club, it was because we were on the Upper West Side. So
right.
They were all there.
Okay.
And it was so funny to watch just this just crowd of Jews just come in mid-show, so excited to see Jerry
bastards.
Seinfeld.
Poor things.
Yeah.
They didn't get to see him. I think it's did you ever write a spec? Wait, you're probably not old enough for that would have been a spec.
Yeah,
I
it
wrote
been
a spec.
Spec.
I wrote a Seinfeld spec.
That's so cool.
It's terrible. So it's not
is
good.
Is it bad?
Well, neither one of this. I wrote a Spin City spec and a Seinfeld spec. And the Seinfeld spec, the only thing I liked out of it wasn't even mine. It was my buddy Jim, who watches it all the time, and I wrote on his idea, and the idea was that George gets on the bus, and the bus driver has a really big belt buckle, and George makes a crack about it, and the bus driver gets really mad at him, and so the rest of the show, George keeps buying bigger and bigger belt buckles, and tries to find that bus driver again.
I like that a lot.
Right, because there's nothing there. That's all it is. It's just him humiliating himself with a giant belt buckle.
Did you ever read the spec script by Billy? Oh, what's his name? He did a Seinfeld the day after 9/11.
Oh, no.
Oh, you haven't read this? It was like, it was this crazy thing. It was a script that went viral.
Yeah.
And it was the funniest thing. Because it was about nothing, but it was like involving all these things. Kramer had lent his box cutters to what ended up being one of the terrorists.
Oh, Jesus
Elaine was about to break up with a guy who was a fireman who went in and now he was a hero, but she was like really trying to break up with him. And it's this incredible. It's I would pay real money to see them read that script out loud.
Wow, that is amazing.
It's amazing. That's
I don't see those guys buying toothpaste and bringing it down for everybody. Remember when everybody was bringing toothpaste to people? Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
They're like, well, I don't know what else to do. And you're like, how about get out of the way? And sure. Sir, that is super dark. I'm surprised, actually, that they haven't done a table read of that for, like, the 25th anniversary. Maybe they'll do it for the 25th anniversary of 9/11.
That would be something.
That'd be super dark. And
I don't know if Michael Richards is like, yeah, let me try. Let me see if I can make this right, the thing I'm known for.
Right. Maybe this is how I rebuild my career. It's yeah. I do feel I don't have any sympathy for Michael Richards. I have sympathy for stand-up comics for actors who start stand-up comedy after they've become famous.
Yeah.
Right? Because he didn't really do stand-up. And then, so he didn't really know how to do crowd control. And the Laugh Factory in LA is, it's a ball pit at a McDonald's. It's dumb. So there's no way to, but what does happen, as you will know from doing stand-up comedy for, by the way, I am talking with Gianmarco Soresi, and it is spelled Soresi, and that is his handle on all the things, and he has a podcast called The Downside, and he's going to be in Toronto, and then he's going to be in Irvine and Oxnard. So go find him and watch him do stand-up comedy. But when you are in a heckler situation, you end up saying the meanest things that you can think of. And I, luckily, the meanest thing is absolutely never have thought, well, I'm going to drop the N-word.
Sure.
But maybe my racism is somehow manifest in a different way. It turns out it's not me saying horrible things to people of color or to Jews or to women. But to other women, I've called other women cunts.
I called someone a cunt in my first year of stand-up, and it was really bad.
You know, it was really – well, and in your first year of stand-up, you don't know when to use like, you blow up too soon.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Which is Michael Richards.
I call men cunts, too, if it helps at all.
Right.
But, it, you know, it was one of those where they were heckling. It was a bar show, and it was this thing where she was like – I would do the setup, and she'd be like, go on. No, keep going. It's one of those things where you're trapped.
You're trapped.
If you go on, you're obeying the heckle.
Right. And she's screwing with your timing. She should be removed immediately. And because that is not how stand-up comedy works. We don't need a cheerleader in the middle of the setup, please.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to stop and to go, if you want to hear this joke, for real, and I assume that you do not, you have to be all super good. Maria Bamford had one of the greatest heckler lines. She was like, I see that you want to be in the show. I'm going to cast you in the show. You are now going to be playing the mute girl and action.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
And so it is a delight to work with Maria Bamford. So, but the thing is... when, like, in my early days, I would blow up too soon, and I would go too dark too quickly.
Yes, Jackie, we heard the punch the wall story. We know that you blew up too soon.
Right, there was trouble. And sadly, that was easily 6 years in. So that should have been.
I feel that all the time. Like, there's nothing, to me, my theory has always been, like, there's nothing funny about real anger, like impotent anger. So, like, sometimes I'll tell an audience member, be like, shut the fuck up. And it's funny.
Yep.
And then there's something that changes in my tone.
Yep.
I go, shut the fuck up.
Yep.
And it's like, boom, the audience goes, whoa.
Yes.
This is not fun.
Right. It's what I call the four levels of heckler. The first heckler you try to ignore. And then the second one, you're like, hey, whisper fucks, what are you, under a helicopter or whatever, right? Uh-huh. You jokingly tell them to shut the fuck up. Third one, you jokingly attack them. And then the fourth level is literally you have to get them out of the room to continue the program. That is when I've decided I don't ever want to get to level to DEFCON 4 ever again, which I think is the other way with DEFCON. But I will I will walk off. I will sit down. I will Chad Daniels this thing. So
what's so funny is like I've done some casinos, seems to be casinos where they're like, if anyone, you need anyone removed, do the classic. They look like they need some water. And was I did it once. There's a bachelorette party. And I was like, they need some water. Some water here for these folks. No one came.
No one came.
And at the end they were like, well, it seemed like you were handling it pretty well up there. And I was like, what do you want? You want me to start crying for you to take me seriously?
Oh, yeah.
Of course I handled it well. That was what I was trying to do. And then you do the secret part.
Yeah.
You be the principal, not me.
Right, right. Your job, the and I've told this story before too, Rangers, you gotta love it, I was doing an Indian casino in northern Michigan where you were not allowed to be mean to the audience and you were not allowed to swear at all. And you couldn't make fun of the casino, which I wasn't going to do, or gambling, which I also wasn't going to do. But there were two super drunk dudes in the front row who would not stop. And finally I was like, can you get your buddy out of here? And he goes, nope. And you ever get so mad? Sometimes in stand-up comedy, you get so mad. You see those red dots. You see those red dots. Uh-huh. And I looked around and for the first time at a casino gig, there was not a security guy. So I literally was like, well, but I can't do anything. And because when you feel that sort of powerlessness on stage, I've decided to never feel that again. But what you do when you think that you're somehow tougher and you can power through this and you don't want to get prorated and you need to get paid. And so you stay up and do your time. You're like, all right. I literally felt at this. I'm pretty proud of myself. I've never done it since, but I fell to my knees and made the sign of the cross and tried to pray them out of the room.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, please, God, bless these men away from me. I hope that they win at all of their cards and games and all the things out of this room. And they did get up and leave. But here's the weird thing. Then I had to stand up. I'm not a gazelle. This I don't fall to the ground and get up, even when I was 40. So it wasn't pretty is what I was saying. I was like, did you guys know I did physical comedy?
You had to call them back to help you up. Yeah, you're like, hey, guys come back here for 1 second.
So I just you know, we're 40 minutes into this thing. What's your favorite episodes?
Well, I think like the interesting about Seinfeld is like I learned a lot about sex from Seinfeld. It was a very like it talked about sex a lot. Like it was very much like, are they staying over? Are we going to be friends and still have sex? And like the two episodes, and I was at that age where it was anything about sex was so titillating,
right?
So just like, oh my God. And one that will always, I'll always remember. I thought, but like as I became an adult, like that sponges were a bigger thing with sex. Because Elaine had a whole episode where, like, the sponge she was using for sex. And again, I didn't even know, does sponge go in? Does it go over? Who the fuck knows? But basically, the sponge is discontinued. So she has, like, five more sponges. And so she's deciding her sexual partners, are they sponge worthy?
And I don't remember that line, but I bet you that was the line.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sponge-worthy was. I mean, this show was so good at coming up with like words and phrases. And so like that's how I learned about like,
right?
I guess you had to be worthy.
Yeah.
About contraceptive. About like you know you gotta be worth it.
Right. Right.
And so like
there was a lot of worth it, whether or not people were worth it socially, whether they were worth it sexually, whether they were. And what was there was George got engaged to some woman who was very wealthy.
What was her name? Susie? Was it Susie?
Susan, maybe?
Susan.
And and he was constantly going, I think the fact that they have a cabin and that she's got all of this crap, like, and Michael Richards' character Kramer was like, her dad's got good cigars, you know, I mean, like all of these things were like, these are on her side. The other side, she snores, she has an eyebrow twitch, some sort of, you know, something in minuscule that you're like, is this like, what are your favorite worth it? Like,
one was kind of the inverse of it was Seinfeld deciding to break up with someone because he had like a voice that he liked to do where he went, hello.
Oh, right,
and he
right.
like thought it was very funny. And this woman was like, the voice has got to stop. You got to pick, is it me or the voice? And then they had this whole montage of like Seinfeld at the beach, like, just contemplating, like, what was worth it, this relationship or this new funny voice. And she comes in one day and she's like, so have you chosen? And he turned to her and said, hello. And she storms out. And it was an amazingly petty show. Petty show.
It was super petty. But there were scenes in it that are iconic, that people still reference. And yeah.
He's dating a woman. I have been in this situation. I'm very bad with names. Oh, terrible with names.
So
embarrassing.
Didn't remember embarrassing. We met at Flappers until you told
sure.
me. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I
was
that
ready.
Guy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You remember Jay, though. That's convenient. But
right.
So
very. 50 years of him staring at me.
But there was an episode where Jerry's dating someone and he does not know her name. And she says, well, people made fun of me because it rhymes with a part of the female anatomy.
Right, right.
And so they're going crazy. And she eventually confronts him, the worst question you want, what's my name? And he can't get it. She leaves. And right as she leaves, he goes, Dolores! Dolores!
Oh, my God. The speculation is that he couldn't also find the clitoris. That would be the joke that I would also. It was like, you would remember the word Dolores if you knew where the clitoris was. Mm-hmm. And that's the joke I would have made. I once, here's too much information. I once had sex with a guy that I thought was his name was Steve. It turns out it wasn't Steve. Or it was. Because I remember I called him Steve and he said, it's Jim or Larry or whatever the hell his name was. And then he got super mad. And
really?
And I saw him like a week later at the bar, at a bar in college. It was just college sex. It wasn't the end of the world. And and he wasn't, it was a weird, the whole experience was not entirely positive. We were on the floor of the laundry room. Anyway, I was a classy dame is what I'm going to say to you, Jim.
Yeah,
I don't know if
yeah.
you know this about me. When I used to drink, I was a lady. Anyway, so I ran into him and I remembered his name when I saw him and I was like, but I called him the wrong name. Speaking of live action pettiness. And so he was very mad. Anyway, so, but he was.
That's crazy to be mad. You met that. Did you
that
meet
night,
that night?
That night.
There wasn't a long courtship period?
There was no courtship. There was little to no courtship. There was a condom. That's what I do distinctly remember at all times. I come from a very fertile people. So, and I didn't want any part of it. So, it's hard to, Dolores, I do remember that episode. I remember the episode where they didn't want to masturbate.
It's
one of the most famous episodes, I think.
One of the most famous, and just again, it's like, you know, a lot with sex, my general theory is like, it's better to like talk about these things early. And I just feel like at an early age, I was like, oh, okay. That was an episode of, oh, everyone does it.
Right.
Like, I think that's a thing people learn sometimes later in life, where it's like, oh, everyone. And like, Elaine being a part of it felt, you know, sure there could be a better feminist message in the grand scheme.
But
like,
time,
in terms of talking about it, yeah.
I think it changed a lot of people's minds about, because nobody really did talk about it. It was sort of like when Bill Hicks first started doing material about porn. Nobody else was doing material about porn, and then nobody can stop. Actually, at this time, currently, nobody can stop doing material about porn. It's got a little world gone bad.
Yeah.
But I will say that Bill Hicks, when he initially talked about porn, he would say he did that sort of line that we've all done since then, which is, oh, I'm the only one.
Yeah.
And it really opened the door for other, for, and if you can admit, that's one of the great things about sitcoms, is that when, like, Will and Grace, I will tell you that Will and Grace did more for gay rights than on any number of things. But if you try to watch Will and Grace right now, you're going to want to cut yourself.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel super even liberal. It feels hard. You're just like, no, I know what you're trying to do. And at the time, they were trying to do so. They were making him into a person, you know, who would happen to be gay.
And that's the thing with, like, Elaine as, like, a character. And you know, this could be because they couldn't write outside of themselves, but, like, Elaine is just as shitty as the rest of them.
She's a monster.
She is just as, like, I'll break up with the guy, I'll fuck the guy. It's just, like, she deals with it in no,
she's one
no
of the
different
guys.
Way. Yeah. They're human. They're all superhuman.
Yes, yes.
And that's what I love about it.
That is pretty great. It is, I don't know. Yeah, I think that her character on that thing was, because they didn't want to make Carol Ann Leifer was who it was based on, I believe, right? Carol Leifer?
I think so, yeah.
And but they didn't want to make it two comedians. And so I forget what Elaine did for job.
Elaine, she did a lot of different things, but ultimately she worked in like fashion, but like more of an assistant. She worked for John O'Hurley. She was like his assistant and helped him with things. So it was this loose kind of fashion, but not like in the artistic element of it.
Okay. Okay. What did, like, I know that George worked for the baseball team for a second, for a hot minute. And then what
George,
did, yeah.
Yeah. I forgot. What did George do? Like, George then got the estate and then he didn't. George was unemployed. Of all the people, George was unemployed.
Almost always unemployed. Yeah. And then Michael Richards, he was always running some scam, right?
Always some scam. Always
did you
some scam.
Like the Paul Reiser spinoff of that show? Did you know that the Helen Hunt Paul Reiser TV show and Friends are in the same universe as Seinfeld?
No.
Yes. Oh my God.
Oh
yes.
Wow.
I might have just blown your mind. Yeah, because Paul Reiser's, Michael Richards is in Paul Reiser's old apartment.
Oh.
He is subletting.
Fascinating.
Yes. And Phoebe's sister was a waitress at a place where Seinfeld and everybody went to.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. So they were all in the same mythical New York where nobody's black. And all three
that
of those,
true.
There's absolutely no people of color.
That is something to remember. Seinfeld was, it was pretty bad. Pretty
right.
bad.
I remember when Aisha Tyler was on Friends and then she did The Dork Forest. And I said, you were on Friends, right? And she was like, Jackie, that was 12 years ago. I have a career. I have a whole career. It's going well. I don't know if you know that. And I was like, I don't. I know that you're very funny. Your stand-up is great. And she was like, let's keep talking about video games. And that episode was actually a great episode of The Dork Forest. If you ever want to listen, to go back into the archives, the long boxes. But what's another favorite?
I mean, Soup Nazi is the most classic. What I love about Soup Nazi is they open up a brand of stores. I mean, think about how are TV shows ever going to be successful to this degree where you open a chain based on a fictional store?
Oh, spun off.
Yes.
Really?
But what I love about it is that, there's several. You can buy it online.
What's it called?
This is
the
funny
Nazi?
Thing. Well, there you go. It's called Soup Man. The Soup Man.
Okay.
And it's very funny because it's his picture on the thing and the actor, I think. And it's like, it's not the Soup Man. It's the Soup Nazi.
Right.
It's a Soup Man. What the fuck is that?
Was it?
But you can't.
You can't call it the Soup Nazi. That's never going to franchise. Wow. I remember that. I know that there's a Bubba Gump that came out of Forrest Gump.
That's true. Bubba Gump's is a brutally bad restaurant.
It's a terrible restaurant that came out of a really, really horrible movie. I've never enjoyed the idea that they made that movie where they celebrated someone so dumb. Anyway, guess
that
what?
Could be I could see that as a series going to every fictional restaurant from things.
Right, right. Yeah, you're just like, oh, are we going to get to go to the Circle Q and Ms. Marvel? Anyway, yeah. So there was a lot of food-related ones, weren't there?
There was a lot. There was a great one was a yogurt shop that opened up that said they were fat-free, but then everyone started putting on weight. And it was because Kramer was the one who was like, yeah, you're getting fat. Like Kramer just told the truth.
Yeah.
And they were shocked. And then they did like a science test to see if it was if there was, you know, fat in the thing. And Newman got really upset. And they had the famous episode called the Chinese restaurant where they were just waiting for a table. And apparently the network was like, what the fuck is this? They just wait for the table the whole episode. They thought it was like the way it sounds like is they were constantly like, are you just being an asshole to us? Like, I don't understand. We gave you a show and
right.
Are you just being a jerk? And yeah. It ended up being so good.
Right, right. Like literally it was. And then wasn't there a meta episode about the fact that the show wasn't about anything?
Well, there was a whole season where Jerry gets a deal to pitch to NBC and they say the show is about nothing. And George, it sounds like Larry David was very difficult when they were pitching this meeting. Like Larry David, if he got notes, he'd go, no, I'm not going to do any of that. And that's what George does in the thing. And yeah, they do a whole season where they cast it.
I want to watch Seinfeld with you, Gianmarco. I don't want to watch it alone. I think that sounds sad. But to watch it with others, I think might be the way to go. My brothers love it.
And then Curb Your Enthusiasm did truly the greatest reunion where they did a whole season of Curb Your Enthusiasm where they bring back, they're going to do a season. And so it's about him cajoling all the four of them to do the show again.
Okay.
And honestly, for Michael Richards, probably the only way that this meta version were they able to like sort of address this thing that felt insurmountable to really come back from.
Yeah, it's really hard when you've made such a huge error of how to apologize and how to not seem insincere because you still want to work. But also
greatest, I mean, I think about it all the time. Jerry Seinfeld, it's Michael Richards is apologizing on, I believe, David Letterman. And Jerry Seinfeld's there and Michael Richards is on the TV screen. He's like live streaming into it. And he comes out there and the audience can't stop laughing. And Jerry Seinfeld goes in a rare moment of just like kind of anger. He goes, it's not funny.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those like a Twilight Zone type thing. This comedian cannot be taken seriously to apologize.
Yeah. Which is sort of the Dice Clay where everyone's like, well, he filled Madison Square Garden with assholes.
Yeah.
Because he was doing a character that was an asshole. And all of a sudden his fan base turns out was made up of people who thought he was serious. And you're like, well, it's the only punishment you get for portraying an asshole is that your fan base becomes jackasses. And so like my fan base, are you kidding? Angels, you Rangers are. You're all just a beautiful bunch of people. But so, okay. There was a babka. There was a babka.
The babka.
That was a food one. I'm kind of interested in the food ones. What is a babka just a pastry? Or is it a bread?
Well, as a Jew, I know every single one of these things. It's like a hearty bread. You can get babka. Like my girlfriend and I made a babka that was like more savory, and there was like pistachio and peppery things. But it can be very dessert based.
Okay.
But it's just like it's a thick loaf.
It's different than challah, though, right? It's not.
Yes. No. Challah is just like it's just a bread.
Just
and
a
the
bread.
Challah bread. Incredible, fluffy. It's light. It's a babka is like it could be an
entree.
Challah,
you want to eat with a nice soup. Maybe, or just as this, you know, you're having a nice meal, you're going to rip off, you're going to enjoy a challah. But a babka, that could be like, that's a special bread that's either sweet or savory that someone has brought. And a chocolate babka is, of course, the gold standard of babka. God knows.
Amazing. It's the best.
It must be.
So they just dealt with, like, Seinfeld dealt with, like, customer service and, like, just the little frustrations in the world. And that stand-up comedian, that was Seinfeld's voice and Larry David's voice. And it just launched so many things. Every time I talk about, you know, complaining about if I try to find a new airplane bit or try to find a customer service bit, it's all like, well, how do I differentiate this from what has been done? And
right.
They did it.
Right, right. Well, and that is, it is hard when there's these sweeping topics that seem to have been nailed, right? Like someone has done my classic example is colorization. Ted Turner invented the colorization of movies, right? Old black and white movies. They're like, people don't like to watch black and white movies. We're gonna make sure that everybody knows the grass is green and her hair is blonde. And so Ted Turner did this, and it was mixed results, right? Most people are like, I'm an adult. I can watch a black and white movie that was purposefully, in some cases, shot in black and white. And Jay Leno, while subbing for Johnny Carson in the early 80s, did what I think is the definitive colorization joke. Because I had just started doing stand-up, so it must have been 84, 85. And I was thinking about doing a colorization joke. And I was watching Carson one night, and I heard him do it. And I was like, well, never mind. And it
What did he say?
It was... He literally just opened his set with, you know, I understand that Ted Turner is colorizing the first 10 minutes of The Wizard of Oz. And the audience shut down on him. They literally were just like, what? And then he had to tag it. And he didn't have a good tag, which is unfortunate, because the joke itself was epic. You know, where there's this, you ever hear a joke and you're just like, I heard one, a Dennis Regan joke the other day. And Dennis Regan, I guess, said, I went swimming, and I'm going to paraphrase, but I went, Dennis Regan, very funny. I went swimming off the coast of Florida and I saw a shark. There's no music. And you're like, oh my God, that is the perfect, that's a perfect shark joke. Sharks, you can still keep writing about sharks. You don't have to stop writing about sharks. But Seinfeld must, if you want to do observational comedy.
Sure.
And did they always show his stand-up at the end of it?
They explored different things at different times. But they would always kind of open with it, end with it. And I think I heard later as like the show went on, he kind of like ran out of like stand up. Sometimes it was relevant and sometimes it was like, this is just a random bit that has nothing to do.
It turns out he does stand up. Did you know he did stand up? I mean, that's all it was, right? It was just because it didn't have anything to do with, they tried to tailor it to the episode?
I think once in a while, but I think like, I don't know, Seinfeld is always like, he's not the most, he doesn't write like a madman. He's not writing a lot of, he likes his perfect bits.
Yeah.
With the perfect callback and the perfect loop. Mm-hmm. And so I just think at a certain point he was like, I don't have any more. So right. I guess we'll do this random skydiving bit. No one goes skydiving in this episode. You're wearing a helmet while skydiving. The helmet's wearing you. Like,
oh,
it's,
it's one of those, is it? And it is too bad that his delivery is so unique and succinct that it can be, that you hear it and there's part of you that balks at laughing at it. Cause I want to laugh at everybody. You know, I'm like, you're doing stand up. If the joke is good, I want to laugh. I don't want to just do that thing that comics often do. We both did it, which is to just go, I see. That's great. And you're like, that's not what anybody's fucking looking for. We would like you to laugh out loud, please.
I'm a dreadful laugher. It's very embarrassing. I'm not happy about it, but I think for me, I really respect a joke if it makes me a little bit mad.
Oh, interesting.
If it makes me I get a little like, I can't help it. It's in my head. I go, fuck, why didn't I fucking think of that?
Were you a good improv person? Were you a supportive improv person?
I don't think I was like a no, I'm going to shut you down. But I think I'm in my head. And I would always be like, I'm the weak link here. I would deteriorate very fast at improv.
And how are you as an actor? Do you know you got to give to receive so that someone has something
for
to play
sure.
off of, right?
For sure. I think I think I'm a decent scene partner. I'm not like a hog on stage, but it's tough. I'm in my head. I'm observing myself. I'm questioning my things.
You want to be the great actor. You want to be the great actor. We all have to figure out how to get it. I remember I was on a panel once with improv people, and they organically knew how not to hog the, like, because they'd been worked in teams for a dozen years, right? And so the third time I interrupted somebody to riff, I literally had, we each had a mic. I would say something. I would put it on my lap and take my hand away. Because in an effort to let others have the panel, right?
That can be nice. But if you're with a group of comics, like sometimes you got to be like, if you do that, you will not speak.
Right. If I'm with stand-ups, you're just like, oh, no, you're going to bust my chops. I have to bust yours back immediately. Otherwise, I am considered less than. Anyway, by the way, it's been an hour, my friend. You have barely scratched the surface of any of your other dorkdoms, but we did get to a pretty in-depth discussion of Seinfeld and what. So there's a documentary about the show.
Documentary. I mean, Curb Your Enthusiasm, the season where he brings back Seinfeld is a like you learn a lot about it.
Okay.
And it's just like. It's amazing because Seinfeld is, again, they said it was too New York, too Jewish. But this show got so specific in a human nature that whenever, you know, it just switched from Hulu to Netflix for $500 million or whatever.
Wow.
And it's just like, it's pretty amazing when comedy gets so specific and so, this has always been my theory with comedy because mine's very first person and narcissistic and self and navel gazing. It's like if you can get so deep in yourself, you can ultimately create something that connects universally. And like Seinfeld did that.
Yeah.
I mean, it does feel like a very Jewish show. And for it to somehow connect to all corners of the world,
it's amazing.
It's incredible.
It's nice to be able to sort of see that sort of representation and then see that it affects everyone, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort of like when you, like, when I talk to somebody who's Latina and they're like, they finally made Coco, you know? And you're like, you know, and everyone loved it. Everyone loved it. And you're like, yeah, because in the end, representation matters and we all want to feel like we matter. And the best way to do that is to go, oh, that's my family. That's how we talk. And you like it too? I am human. And that is a nice thing. That's awesome. Gianmarco, thank you so much for coming on the Dork Forest.
Thank you.
It's at your name. Why don't you say it?
It's at Gianmarco Cerezi.
Gianmarco. It's not Gian. Yeah. I see. I want to Italian it. It's Gianmarco Cerezi. So at Gianmarco Cerezi, it is spelled in the notes, everybody. Go find him on Instagram and Twitter and Venmo. Yeah, what the hell? Just Venmo the guy.
He's, please.
What is he? He lives in New York. And you have shows in Toronto in July, 22nd and 23rd. And you are also at the Irvine Improv or whatever it's called at 8-7 and the Oxnard Levity Live or whatever it's called on 8-10. And you have a podcast called The Downside.
The Downside.
Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
Liz Winstead here, co-creator of The Daily Show and co-host of the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod. Well, the vaginal crossing guards on the Supreme Court have destroyed Roe v. Wade. Good news, my nonprofit Abortion Access Front can help. On July 17th, we're hosting an activist training day called Operation Save Abortion. We're gathering experts from every area in the field of abortion justice and live streaming a series of conversations that break down the many opportunities available to you to protect access to all things reproductive care. Helping patients with travel needs, lobbying politicians, and getting into good trouble out in these streets are just a few examples that these amazing panels are going to break down and, bonus, connect you to the organizations in your area doing this work. So gather your friends for a watch party, then commit to becoming a defender of abortion access. I'll be there, and so should you. Operation Save Abortion, July 17th. For all the info and to register, hit up OperationSaveAbortion.com.
My hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?